If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
The Sound Podcast is part of the OSIRIS Network. OSIRIS is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. We'll be doing many live events this summer around the country, which will include artist interviews, contests, and more. Sign up for our newsletter at OSIRISpod.com to stay in the loop. Relics Magazine is a media partner of OSIRIS. For more, visit relics.com. The show starts now.
Never seems to work out how you planned it. Oftentimes I think that's for the best. Don't think I'll ever understand it. Must just be a lucky guy, I guess.
I've been dreaming country tunes and love songs.
Wish that I could sing them all to you.
When I tried writing down, never can remember. Rack my brain and see if I can come up with something new. Oh. Sing into a microphone. As long as I'm still standing on this earth, I've been dreaming country tunes and love songs.
I wish that I could sing them all to you.
When I tried to write them down, I never can remember. Rack my brain to see if I can up with something new.
You've been listening to Country Tunes and Love Songs from Hot Buttered Rum's forthcoming release, Lonesome Panoramic, featuring the Kofis Brothers. We've been big fans of this West Coast, mainly bluegrass outfit for quite some time, and are really impressed with their latest effort, which continues to be an eclectic blend of bluegrass, Americana, and of course, rock and roll. Recently, we caught up with multi-instrumentalist and one of the two voices in the band, Eric Yates, to learn more about their latest release, their sixth, Lonesome Panoramic, and about the inner workings of Butter. Our conversation started when I asked Yates to explain what West Coast bluegrass was all about.
Not to get too highfalutin sounding, but, you know, jazz is something that came from New Orleans. Went to New York. Those are the two cities people think of when they think of jazz. And in the 50s, Jerry Mulligan and, you know, some of the other cats out in L.A. started doing something they started calling kind of West Coast jazz. I might have my history wrong or my dates wrong on that, but I saw that and sort of thought, yeah, it's still jazz. If you listen to Jerry Mulligan Quartet, it's definitely, there's nothing not jazz about it, but it's got a different take on it. I don't know if you could call it more laid back or maybe just a little bit more eclectic or a little bit, because it's further from the source of where the music was born. There's changes that happen to it along the way. So I think of West Coast bluegrass as definitely like it's influenced by, well, it takes its core from Flatt & Scruggs and Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers and Jim and Jesse and all the great like first and second generation bluegrass bands. But it's also, we're also really influenced by pickers on the West Coast, guys like David Grisman, Peter Rowan, John Hartford, even though he's not a West Coast guy, but he was, you know, a big kind of patron saint of the bluegrass out there, as well as the, you know, Jerry Garcia, Olden and the Way phenomenon that was a big, you know, kind of explosion of bluegrass music out to deadheads and other kind of West Coast music fans. So, you know, mixing that up and then just having like a sense of the main thing I would say is that with a lot of West Coast bands, not all, there's certainly some very traditional and very dyed-in-the-wool great players on the West Coast. But as far as our little branch of it, it's, I think the difference is we have experimentation kind of baked into our genes as opposed to it being something that we add a little bit of here and there. You know, there's, I think like that's the difference between like groups like ours and other kind of West Coast groups, maybe you could even include Grisman and other people like that, that are, we just kind of started experimenting from the beginning as opposed to, you know, some of the groups like, or people like Vernon Ray who were coming from the South to California, but still bringing this real, you know, iron spine of bluegrass traditionalism with them. I think we've always just heard it as one of the many kinds of music that we love, because almost everyone, no one growing up on the West Coast that I knew grew up in a household that listened to just bluegrass music, whereas that's a reality in lots of other parts of the country, you know, especially in the South, where people really just, they grow up with it as their music, as the only music that they have in the house, to a certain extent, you know, along with like some country and some other stuff. But that's, everybody on the West Coast that I knew grew up listening to 5 or 6 or 7 different kinds of music. You know, from jazz to psychedelic rock to bluegrass to country to everything. So that's just kind of part of the DNA of just about every kind of West Coast music that I've heard, from funk bands to, you know, indie rock bands to bluegrass bands.
Do you think specifically because you are in San Francisco and more specifically in Marin that the history of the musicians, particularly post, let's say, post 70-ish, and the history of all of those musicians, and I know that you mentioned a few of them, that has a lot to do with the stuff that probably you grew up listening to in your home as a young kid, and that you've grown and that you've furthered as you've gotten older. I mean, that
absolutely,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, to clarify, two of the guys live in San Francisco, one of the guys is in Marin, and then myself and the fiddle player are off in different parts of the country at this point. But the band's core is in San Francisco, and San Francisco has always been, kind of a wild and woolly music town. I mean, it might be a little bit less so these days, but, you know, it was a hub of a lot of activity, especially 60s, 70s, 80s for music, you know. Especially bands that played live. It wasn't necessarily the biggest hub on the West Coast for recording, although it's one of the main ones. There's some amazing recording studios there, and back in the day, you know, people would come from far and wide. But, you know, so I think it was competing a lot with LA for that title for a while. But certainly for bands that love to play live and were looking for a way to make their mark outside of the traditional industry model, I feel like San Francisco has been right at the forefront of that.
And I think to a certain degree what's going on now, I mean, ALO is a guest, or at least two members of ALO are a guest on the record. There seems to be a resurgence of kind of the music scene, and I think that's in large part to what's going on at Terrapin Crossroads, right? I mean, you can...
My assessment is that Terrapin Crossroads is really trying to actively re-inject life into a music scene that, in my experience, has largely been dampened by the rise of money culture in the Bay Area. It's just a very, very expensive place to be. I'm not necessarily making a value judgment on that, but I mean, I'm one case that's included, but a lot of artists, musicians, and creatives are not able to live in the Bay Area anymore. So places like Terrapin, I mean, Phil's done such a great job. Phil and Jill, we're putting that venue together and saying, yes, we're going to have music here every day at happy hour. You come to Terrapin and there's live music every week, and there's music so that people know that, hey, there's just music with a capital M at this location. We can always go there. We can have, I think that's what it takes to build community. And I'm glad they were able to create that venue. Also, Bob Weir and his partners with the Sweetwater in my hometown of Mo Valley, you know, just creating a place where you just know there's good music there. And that way, I mean, the Sweetwater was like the place I grew up going to and listening to outside of, because I couldn't get in, you know, for a long time until I got my first ID, which of course was when I was 21.
But
seeing great musicians come and play these, the little bars in town, because that town was the home to Bobby Weir and Grace Slick and, you know, Jerry Garcia and all these, kind of 70s music icons were living there. So I think that those guys have kind of thrown their hat in the ring and said, okay, we're going to create the frame for these other people to come fill in and have it happen often. Hopefully that'll keep happening. You know, there's certainly the backing for it and the desire for it. It's just, you know, whether or not these places can keep the lights on.
Almost 20 years into this now, do you think that you have a better handle on what your sound specifically is? I mean, it is, you know, at the heart of it is bluegrass, but it is a little more than just bluegrass. I mean, you guys do experiment and you know, try, well, you added a drummer and you try things that are more rock based. I mean, at this point, do you know what Hot Buttered Rum is, or is it this thing that's constantly evolving?
Let's say there's a two-part answer to this question, because this is the question that musicians get asked probably most. Do you know what your music is? The easiest answer is no, we don't. We are making the music that we're making because it's coming through us, and we're trying to just create it. And, you know, the high artist move would be to like leave it to other people to sort of decide what it is. And there's a certain element of that. I think if you're thinking too much about what am I producing, it starts to get a little bit formulaic. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, so with my left hand, I'm holding that reality. With my right hand, I'm holding the reality that yes, we know what we're doing to a certain extent. We're making choices, I think, based on more on what we want to leave out than what we want to put in there. And that's where I think that West Coast mentality comes back in to play, where we start off with this very, very broad field of possibilities. And our job is to actually kind of narrow it down, you know, as opposed to, I don't know, like a band like maybe Town Mountain from the Southeast, that they might want to, you know, they're so steeped in bluegrass and so amazing at it that for them, it might be really exciting to add something new to the stream and go, okay, what if we cover this Bruce Springsteen song? What does that sound like?
Right.
You know, with us, it's almost like, okay, what if we don't, what if we don't integrate any, you know, Afrobeat ideas into this record? What if we don't integrate anything from outside the U.S.? And even within the U.S., we just kind of keep it to like the bluegrass music that we love, plus some country, plus some, you know, psychedelica, and maybe a little bit of jazz or blues, you know, on these three songs. And that's like, that for us is, it's really hard work. And, you know, sometimes we, I think sometimes we succeed with flying colors, and sometimes it's still a work in progress.
So with all of that knowledge, obviously, that's why you have to self-produce your own records, right? Because you, not, you collectively, the royal you, collectively understand the sound. And so when you go into Panoramic House Studio to record the record, you know, there's an engineer, of course, and there's people mixing and mastering the record, but it's the band collectively, or with you and Keith sort of taken the controls. I'm not sure how it works, but I would assume it's probably pretty democratic in terms of producing the record and knowing how you guys want the songs to sound, right?
I mean, that's what, it's interesting. That's what we did with this record. With the last three records, or is it the last, maybe the last four records, we've worked with producers. And that's also a real relief in a way. Like, we worked with this great one of our acoustic heroes, Mike Marshall, on our second studio record. And he pushed things in a very concretely eclectic, acoustic direction. Like, whenever somebody's like, hey, I really like you guys, the bluegrass stuff you guys play and the real, you know, kind of instrumental stuff that you guys, okay, I tell them, hey, listen to Willow Machine. You know, that's Mike Marshall. He's playing on there. Daryl Engel's playing on there. Peter Rowan's singing on there. There's no drums. There's a lot of double mandolin stuff because we had a mandolin, you know, guru kind of working with us. And we're able to, like, really focus on that one aspect of what we do. Next album was with a rock and roll producer. We added drums. We added some horns on some things, organ, and pushed it kind of in that direction. But at the same time, it's nice to self-produce because we can sort of pick and choose, like I said, from all those options to see what we want the record to sound like and how can we create a record that's going to be, you know, as close to a comprehensive statement of what we love about music and the way we love to make it as possible.
So what I found about this record is that it is eclectic in parts. I mean, Treasure Island Blues is not a straight ahead bluegrass tune or the Deep End or the one that everybody knows necessarily. So they are eclectic in terms of bits and pieces, but it still holds together. And I think a lot of that has to do with the songwriting and your songwriting and Nat's songwriting. Is that fairly accurate?
Well, great. I'm really glad that that's what you're hearing. That means a lot. We're still on the stage where, even though we're done with the record, we love to solicit people's opinion. Like, does this thing hold together? Because, you know, I can feel any which way about it, but a lot of it has to do with folks like you that listen to tons of records. And I'm glad to hear about it. And I've gotten some really good feedback on it from people. It's interesting, I'll just say real quick, producing records in this day and age, because the way people listen to records is so different. I listen to records, you know, soup to nuts, pretty much. That's how I like to do it. It's actually relatively easy to do that, fortunately, on most listening platforms, if you subscribe. But a lot of people are YouTubing it, or they're using the free version of Spotify or whatever, and it'll play one track and then go to somebody else's music and then back to your music. Or it'll play the record, but not in order. So individual singles are kind of, I mean, you know, you've heard a lot of this too, but the single is kind of back, because you could put out a record that sounds great start to finish, but it might be just one song off that record that really, you know, has legs and that goes out into the world and touches people. And people can very easily just have that one song in their life without getting, you know, buying an $18 CD and, you know, skipping the track four every time it comes up.
Which is a shame, I think, because people who are only listening for a single may not hear things like country tunes and love songs, which ultimately is, I think, for me at least, one of the best songs on the record. And it's because ultimately I think that's what we're always listening for or trying to write or trying to mimic in our lives. I mean, it's such a, it is such a poignant lyric. And the fact that it's the chorus, I mean, it just hit me. I went back like three or four times, even though the title of the track is Country Tunes and Love Songs. I went back three or four times just to make sure that I had the phrasing correct in my mind, because I felt that that was one of the most poignant points on the record. I mean, is that what you think about when you're writing music is, you know, what is the statement I'm trying to make? And ultimately, is the statement somewhat similar? I mean, this record could easily be been called a ode to Northern California or several of the other things. And a lot of that is love. I mean, it's not love between two people. It's love between people and their environment or whatever. But I mean, is that the Holy Grail, sort of writing country tunes and love songs?
I think when writing a song, I try to, like, this is, I can only speak for myself, but I try to not think about whether or not it's going to connect with a lot of people, whether or not it's going to go out there and do big things in the world until I'm, like, finishing it up. And a lot of times it's the editing part where I'm like, okay, cool, I just spit all this out because it needed to come out, or I just was really interested to see what it would come out, or wanted to take this guitar pattern and just put any words to it that made sense. And that, but it, you're right, in that second phase when I'm going, okay, how much more am I going to give this song? Is this just something I'm going to file away, you know, in a folder and on my desktop and just leave it? Or am I going to bring this to the band? Am I going to bring this to Hot Buttered Rum? Am I going to bring this to one of my other projects? Or am I going to sit on it? Like, there's a couple songs on that record. You talked about the one that everybody knows. I wrote those words for a totally different project, for a duo thing that I had in the Bay Area probably 6 or 7 years ago, and forgot about it. And then we, you know, as a part of the process, every time Hot Buttered Rum makes a record or anything else that I'm involved in, but, you know, mostly it's been Hot Buttered Rum, I try to really go back and dig through all my songs and see what songs I want to bring to the band. A, so that we can have the most options possible, and B, so that I don't overlook anything. And I was surprised to see how that song kind of came to life. I actually had two versions of that with totally different melodies and chord progressions, because that was a song that, for me, it was an unusual process in that I wrote the words out completely and then didn't know what the music was going to sound like. So I actually sent both versions to the band, and they overwhelmingly picked that second one. And so I think that the initial creative process doesn't have anything to do with where the song will go, because it just, I feel like it just comes out more cleanly if you open up just open up the fire hose and let it spray. But everything after that, yeah, we're trying to think about where is this going to lead the sound of the band, where is this going to lead the sound of the record, and is it something that's going to sound good with these particular instruments too?
Right. Is this project still, you know, you and Nat bringing music to the table, or does everybody sort of contribute, or is it, you know, we pick five from you and five from you, or how does that process work? Because I would imagine with two primary songwriters, that could get more complex than we know.
It's definitely more complex to have two songwriters than to have one. Bands I know is like Railroad Earth are pretty good friends of ours, and they have basically one songwriter, or when other people bring in songs, it kind of, you know, funnels through this one person's voice for the most part, with the exception of, you know, their fiddle player who sings and writes some awesome songs too. But I know with Hot Buttered Rum, we not only have two songwriters, we have two singers who will sing lead regularly. So occasionally Nat and I will collaborate on a song, which is probably the best way to get it to sound most like a Hot Buttered Rum song, because I kind of come in from my angle and he comes in from his. The two of us bring in most of the new material to the band, with the exception of some instrumental stuff. Like, I think the last instrumental tune that got brought in, you know, Zebulon, our fiddle player, brought that in because that's sort of his department. And then there's also oftentimes usually cover songs suggested by our drummer James, our bass player Brian, to fill in the set or something that would be, you know, cover songs are another thing that are really, they're really kind of back. I don't know if they ever really went away, but like, especially with so many bands from Nikki Bloom, Lake Street Dive, getting noticed initially by a really awesome cover that they did of somebody else's work. Like, I think people are seeing that and trying to get their cover tunes up on people's playlists and up on people's YouTube channels to, you know, get their sound out there, which is, I love it. This is like an amazing time to listen to different versions of songs, you know, because everybody's coming at it from all these different directions.
It's very much a jam band kind of thing, the cover song, whether it's, you know, Nikki or Fish or even the Grateful Dead or, you know, going back.
Yep.
That's very
yeah,
much.
Yeah, man, the Dead were kind of pioneering that back before it was cool.
Yeah.
They really were.
I'm curious about some of the guests on the record. Obviously, Lebo and Gil are on the record because you've had a long relationship, you know, doing Camp Deep End and just living in where you guys live. But Rainbow Girls are great, and I'm curious to know how you connected with them and added them to the festivities on this record.
We connected with them. By the way, I should give you a 2-minute warning because I got to hop off in just a couple here. But
cool.
We connected with them initially through them opening for us at one of our shows. And
cool.
We just, you know, they obviously, as you can hear, have a really great vocal blend. And also the Koffis brothers, who co-wrote and appeared on that song, Country Tunes and Love Songs, they too, we've played shows with them. I think even they've opened up for us. We did a co-bill, and they're fantastic. Definitely, you know, have them on the show. They're great.
Thanks so much for taking the time, man. Really appreciate it. Really love the
Absolutely.
Record. Really love the record, and I can't wait to catch you on the road and listen more. So congratulations on a great record.
Yeah,
and
I'd love to get us up to Ontario some of these days.
We'll catch up real soon, man. Thanks for taking the time.
Okay. Thanks,
Ara. A fascinating conversation, and had we had more time, I'm sure we would have dug even deeper into West Coast bluegrass and all things butter. Suffice it to say, this is an extraordinary band with great songs and genuine musical chops. To learn more about HBR, visit hotbutteredrum.net. Before we leave you, have a listen to The Deep End, a song inspired by Camp Deep End, the festival HBR stages each year with ALO. Joining HBR on this track are Zach Gill and Dan Lebo Leibowitz of ALO. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm dipping in the deep end, gonna leave some things behind. I'm dipping in the deep end, gonna leave some things behind. I might have lost the keys to the kingdom that might be in my pocket, but I don't mind. On my own two feet. Sometimes I'm sleeping, sometimes I'm walking on my own two feet. By the time I get to the deep end, they're gonna be walking to a deep end.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. Subscribe to our newsletter today at thesoundpodcast.com/subscribe. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. The Sound Podcast is part of the Osiris Network. For more, visit osirispod.com. Thanks for listening.
Osiris.